All right, Crypt Nation, you guys know what time it is. It is time to go register for the free online summit that we are hosting called Crypto 2020 Summit. You could go to crypto2020summit.com. It is going to be the single largest crypto event of the year, hands down. We got well over 60 speakers already signed up to speak and present on their predictions for 2020. So if you guys don't want to miss out on all the big trends, this is a free event. It's online. You could watch it from the comfort of your own home. Go to crypto2020summit.com and register today. All right. What is up, good citizens of Crypt Nation? Glad to be here with my boy, Pizza Mind. How you doing, man?
I have returned from Singapore, triumphant and victorious, and yes. Also with a sore throat.
Oh, no. I'm sorry to hear that. But somebody is joining us today on a very special episode of Crypto 101, gracing us with his presence is the head of growth at Blockstack, Mr. Patrick Stanley. Welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So Blockstack is really interesting. You guys recently did a $50 million raise on a Regulation A-plus offering for securities. And for those of you who haven't heard of Blockstack, they're building essentially a new freaking internet. One that protects your privacy, that protects all your rights, that you have to, you authenticate everything that uses your data with your private key. It's a decentralized computing network and app ecosystem. It's almost like, I don't want to get too much into it. I'll let Patrick do all that fun stuff. So Patrick, real quick, give us the high level on Blockstack. What is it and what is the main goal that you guys are trying to accomplish here?
Yeah, sure. You kind of started getting into it. It is an app ecosystem built on a blockchain where users have ownership over their identity, over their data, and they're free to connect with their friends without any third parties in between. So what we're trying to do here, our mission is to upgrade the internet and give essentially users back their data dignity and their right to own things online. And so the key sort of core promise is allowing apps to be built on the platform that can't be evil. So that's like, I use can't be evil in quotes because it's definitely a spectrum of privacy preservation and kind of like user-centeredness that can be created. But if you think about kind of like Google in the early days, they had don't be evil. And that was a function of them being able to amass so much control over user data and we're kind of like taking the exact kind of opposite.
I love that. That's a perfect explanation. So it's almost like you guys are, I mean, there's so many different apps that could be built. I mean, it's just this big decentralized database. I mean, you could build decentralized search engines, right? On top of it, you could build a decentralized app store, all sorts of different cool stuff. And why is it so important that users own their own data and their own identity? And what does that look like?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I can pretty much say any day of the week, any day of the year. Did you hear what happened with Facebook? And it's typically a valid question.
So true.
I think these are just the things that we're hearing about on a daily basis. And so what I'm speaking to here is like the hacks, the abusive data. Essentially, we're living online like insecure digital feudal serfs. I think the day will come when we start taking back ownership over our right to own our own data and have apps compete over us. So right now there's like, we use the internet today and I feel like most people are pretty happy with their experience but feel kind of helpless when it comes to like essentially large data monopolies owning, like running the internet and being beholden to whatever they say or whatever happens to them. And I think what we're seeing is a big, essentially uprising of people that are ready for something new. And so they're starting to build hundreds of apps on this platform. They're starting to use the applications in a way that preserves the user's data dignity. And so I would say like one other thing because I think we're like totally living in a local maximum on the internet, meaning we're in this place that is better than we were before from like a user experience standpoint from like mm-hmm. the '90s, but we could be in a far more innovative place when it comes to, apps getting delivered direct to consumer, just straight from the keyboard essentially. And so we want to usher in like a whole new age of innovation that happens from removing barriers to entry and removing third parties.
So it's almost like a decentralized app store in the sense that, you know, there's no quote unquote Apple company to take 30% and to, you know, 30% of the developer's revenue, and then also have, you know, subjecting the developers to all these different regulations, and then maybe one day changing an API call that, you know, breaks somebody's applications. There's none of that, right?
Absolutely. That's a really great way of describing it, like essentially a decentralized app store. It's one that anyone can curate. And I think what's interesting about that is you have all sorts of risk as a developer building applications. So if you're a developer building on Slack or on Facebook or using Twitter APIs, you're subject to the whims of that company. So you have platform risk, meaning that company could just one day say, oh, we're shutting you off. In the Blockstack world, you push an application and everyone on the Blockstack network can pull down that application and use it with their friends and also use it not necessarily without you needing to provide any further sort of services. The other thing is right now the applications are mostly web apps and some mobile web apps. The very few native applications for like iPhone or Android, and we're still kind of determining sort of what our strategy is there, whether to like lean into kind of like native app support, but there is a platform risk in the iPhone ecosystem and the iOS ecosystem and the Android ecosystem. When you've seen sort of crypto-centric applications be pulled down from that app store. So while in some of those applications, they're not all nefarious. Some of those applications are actually just really well-intentioned apps. So we have there is essentially a large tech company with the ability to set the standards for what kind of apps want to live on their platform. And we just think like the freedom to innovate is equally as important as like the freedom to escape from essentially these like tech monopolies and use something that's built around you.
So you're talking about apps that aren't governed by anyone. And let's highlight just a little bit. I mean, where you said, you know, an API could shut off. It's not just as simple as, oh, the developer has to upgrade this API and push a fix. They can simply disable this product that they've had that other developers are reliant upon. And those guys are out of business. Their products are done.
Totally.
A great example of that was when Google disabled Android's Internet of Things operating system. Mm-hmm. And dozens of companies, including here, some here in the crypto space, had to literally start over from scratch on all their development and build on something like Raspbian or whatever else that they needed to do. It just disabled years of work because Google didn't feel like making this product available anymore. And that's why this is such a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an app I used to use called Path. It was built by actually our advisor, Dave Morin, who's like a total product genius. And it was like the most loved app that had failed. And when if you had all your stuff stored there, you no longer have access to it. Whereas like in a Blockstack world, there's not necessarily a concept of an application needing to die because it like runs out of funding. People can still run those applications locally on their phones or on their computers and use them to communicate with people. So it's almost like heirloom applications. But yeah, totally, man. Like I think that goes to the platform risk thing. It's like if you're building a trusted brand, you want to be able to deliver on your promise that you're going to be able to serve people for longer than however long the platform that you're operating on decides to let you. That's why blockchains are so interesting. They don't necessarily die. Like that, they're a really great coordinating function and kind of like a good place to start from sort of building a trusted ecosystem.
100%. And so. Tell me a little bit about the differences between a platform like Ethereum and a platform like Blockstack.
Yeah, sure. So Ethereum started through the lens of smart contracts being the kind of like center of everything. And with that brought a lot of experimentation because there's this like novel function where you could program computation to happen automatically. And what we believed from the very, very early on, and we have blog posts on this, dating back to like 2016, 2015, we don't believe that blockchains scale. And so what we did was instead of focusing on smart contract lines, we actually focused on the data and identity side of things. And so, for example, if you're using, I need to check on this today, and I would ask folks to sort of do your own research. But if you're using sort of like a Twitter clone on Ethereum, like how they would think through that, how they have thought through that, is essentially, you know, use a smart contract to pay a little bit of Ether to post a tweet. And you post the tweet, you know, there's friction there, costs money, and then everyone can like see the tweet. In the Blockstack world, we don't think that should necessarily cost, we don't necessarily think that friction should be introduced. And also we see it as a potential scaling issue. If you get a bunch of people trying to tweet, they're using the smart contracts, they like overload the network, and you have a situation like I did with CryptoKitties, which was a digital collectors sort of game on top of Ethereum, where it slowed down the entire network and essentially clogged up the network. And so like you don't want that from a user experience standpoint. You want to be able to compete on an application level, apples to apples, and even better apples to apples with centralized apps. Like our whole theme is around user privacy, data dignity, and the sort of theme around Ethereum is kind of one of like a world computer, which has it has shown cracks, and they're currently upgrading to Ethereum 2.0. So that'll be a few years of development there, kind of like starting again.
Where are you guys at in terms of development, and when or how can the general public participate in this environment?
Yeah, sure. So it's super early days, but compared to this time last year, we had about 17 apps on the platform. Today, I think we have over 320. And most of these apps are currently being built by people most of them are being built by sort of like hobbyists or people who kind of like believe in this new future and want to usher it through. There's some very professional teams, but a lot of people are sort of like starting to enter the ecosystem at an accelerating rate. And all these folks essentially have the one thing in common, which is they're looking to build trusted brands that preserve, that can't be evil to their end users. I know I say that a lot, but it's worth repeating. So people can check out Blockstack apps by just going to app.co/Blockstack. The more you use Blockstack apps, the better your experience should get over time. I'm talking over the course of like years, you know, so let's say like the expectation today, like November of 2019, is that there's a lot of green shoots, a lot of new apps, and that the quality of apps has been actually increasing in quality ever since, and will, and it's projected to continue.
What do you think the biggest like barrier to entry or the hardest part of using the platform is when compared to a traditional centralized competitor?
Yeah, sure. So I think the concept of holding onto private keys is a very difficult one for like grandma and grandpa to wrap their heads around. However, we have a pretty stellar product team who's in the process of sort of like making that a lot more smooth. And we've done a lot of things to kind of make it more familiar for like the general user. But I'd say conceptually, private keys are different or a whole different thing from username and password. Like I have 200 usernames and passwords for various applications I use around the internet. But I only really use one. My single Blockstack ID. That's like my single sign-on to all my apps in the Blockstack ecosystem. So in that sense, it is better. Once you're onboarded, you don't need to use passwords, and it's way better than a centralized app. But the onboarding, I think most of it is like our product team is working on featuring like the privacy elements of it rather than necessarily complicating things with the identity and sort of public-private key aspects of it. It's kind of a lot of it's like a big practice in getting out of your own way.
So how does the Blockstack token work in the ecosystem? And is it the same thing as a Security Reg A Plus, or is there another utility token? Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure thing, yeah. So it's all the same token. And right, like there's phases to sort of like what the token can be used for. So initially, you can use the token to purchase digital names, like human readable names. Like, you know, you could buy, you know, John Smith 242.id. And what happens is you pay a little bit of token, you burn it, the network can see that you burnt it, and it registers a human readable name that no one can take away from you. So that's one thing. So you can think of that as like a decentralized GoDaddy or Namecheap, where, you know, people are buying human readable names.
Like a DNS or a website or something.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't know whether to go that deep on the crypto 101. But it's exactly like that. Yeah. It's like the centralized DNS. We call it BNS, Blockstack Name System. So that's one thing. The next thing that's going to happen is we're rolling out smart contract language that's built on the Stacks blockchain early next year. And that will allow for hyper secure, hyper-transparent, hyper-predictable smart contract creation. I think this is important. So I think this is important for like reinforcing kind of like trusted sort of like protocols built on top of a Blockstack. So that's going to allow for a lot of experimentation safely. And I think like really, really professional developers are going to prefer that over the current options available in the sort of blockchain space.
Do you have a friend who's interested in getting into cryptocurrency, but they don't know where to start building their portfolio? Well, we have the answer. It's called CopyTrader by eToro. With CopyTrader, you can automatically copy every trade of eToro's top crypto traders, just like myself or Bryce or Kevin, at the exact price point and in real time. No need to study up on markets or develop your own strategies. Simply just sign up and copy our trades. Any profits that we make, you do too. Proportional to your investment, of course. With eToro, you get access to the world's most popular cryptocurrencies with transparent trading fees all in one easy-to-use app. Copy the smart money with eToro. Join now at etoro.com/crypto101. Thank you.
You know, when we think about protocols, like now in this day and age, we're investing in networking protocols. Is that fair to say? Like when you buy Bitcoin, you're buying a piece of this network, essentially.
Yeah, you're buying. I think you're buying what Bitcoin stands for, too.
Okay, I see. And so, like, I guess the point I'm trying to make here is, you know, when we're buying a Blockstack token, or when somebody is, you know, what are they buying? Are there going to be applications built on top of Blockstack that, you know, you could transfer value between, but you're going to need the token? Or is it literally, you know, you just the only, like, I don't know, like, could you just talk a little bit more about the use cases of it?
Yeah, sure. So I was mentioning,
what are you getting?
Sure. So I was mentioning, right now the biggest user of Blockstack are developers who are like rapidly developing apps. There's like 30 to 50 new apps built every single month. And what they're doing currently, which was they're building applications and earning the Stacks token as a function of building great apps through this program that we're piloting called App Mining. So App Mining pushes apps in the direction of building their infrastructure in a way that really, really protects users' data. So like when people are building apps, they can choose to send data anywhere they want, right? Like the brand promise is only enforced by folks who sort of abide by it. And so we're accelerating the development of applications that do put users at the center of the experience and in control, and who also get the most amount of usage. So that's where we're trending toward with that program. So I'd say like when you look at what Stacks represent, you can look at it as the currency, the only currency you can use to buy a digital asset. So that's like a namespace, which can give you access to apps, or you can also have, you can also buy sort of a name that you buy a name that represents a subscription, you know, so it could be like access control. And so, and then the other thing is like compute. So you can think of like stacks being used as like AWS credits and to power applications if need be, right? And I think what's going to happen is like when you look at things from the very beginning with stacks, it's important to recognize like the usage of stacks should increase over time, given like what is available to be hacked on. So like right now, developers cannot use the stacks token to power smart contracts until the beginning of next year. Once they do that, people will be deploying smart contracts and fueling them with the stacks token. I think just like, so I think there's going to be a lot of experimentation there. There's going to be a lot of experimentation around purchasing digital assets and having them be represented by something. And also sort of powering applications and computation and even like servers, like third-party servers that are decentralized in some parts. So I think like kind of like when you, I mean, when I look at kind of like 5 years, 8 years in the future, what I see is stacks sort of representing both the concept of like a new internet that people want to usher forward, given like the app mining program, given like building smart contracts that ensure predictability, and also the right to purchase your own digital real estate. So it's kind of like a digital nation state in a way.
That's a really cool idea. I like that concept of the digital nation state. It's kind of like how I feel about what Facebook is trying to do with Libra. They got more users than any single country has citizens. And, you know, I think we're kind of getting ushered towards a world here, you know, in the next 10, 20 years of, you know, I think like Facebook will literally be considered like a sovereign country or like, yeah, like our conceptions of borders and nation states is going to be completely deconstructed.
Yeah, for sure. There's this great book called The Sovereign Individual that kind of outlines all this stuff.
I'll check it out.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. It was written in 1997, and it's extremely prescient. Like they predict Bitcoin down to like scary detail. they also predict the rise of nationalism, and they predict a whole bunch of other things. It's like really kind of like looking into the future in some sense. Like obviously you take it with a grain of salt because you gotta think for yourself. But yeah, I think no doubt. Like I think like the nation, like sort of. I kind of feel like the nation state and the traditional internet are sort of incompatible fundamentally.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you're starting to see this happen with Facebook butting up against Congress. Like if you ask a congressperson how they feel about Facebook, they don't like them at all.
Ever. Yeah. Never have anything nice to say to Mr. Mark Zuckerberg.
Well, they don't. I think they're trying to figure out what to actually do with them. Because like if you think about Facebook, yeah, they have all these digital citizens, right? And they don't yet have a currency. They don't yet have an army, which is good, I guess, for now. Because like, who knows what arises out of that? That's too interesting.
Yeah.
And so, right now, they have the ability to sway any election they want, in large part because they control information. Like the creators of the algorithms control. Like Google and Facebook can sway an election if they want to. And so, nation states. They kind of like cautiously know this. They sort of cautiously know this, but there's kind of little they can do because these companies are typically global companies. They're operating in many different countries. So it's going to be, I think, the next 7 years between like Facebook and Google and the U.S. government and China. That's going to be something that I think accelerates the adoption of something like Blockstack.
The word for 2020 is going to be interoperability, which means all these different ecosystems and blockchains working together and being able to access one another's data. What is Blockstack's opinion on interoperability in the first place? Or do you really want to have your own sovereign, completely closed system that protects your users?
Yeah, it's a great question. I won't speak on behalf of Blockstack because this is like a pretty meaty question. But I would say I really believe in minding your own business in a way. I believe if you're going to enforce certain digital rights to the quote unquote digital citizens of your projects, like on top of your blockchain. And you would need to ensure that the sort of corresponding party doesn't do anything to impede on your digital citizens' rights. I'm using those terms because we talked about the nation state stuff, but interoperability, I think from an investor standpoint, it's super interesting. Because you think, okay, well, where is the opportunity between the glue that connects these blockchains, right? But I think the reality is most of these projects are still like little kids kind of like trying to reach for the top shelf of the cookies, and they're nowhere close, right? So what we're kind of doing is just like focus, like for the time being, our heads are like, we're very focused on just growing our own community and not necessarily diffusing our focus for the time being with sort of like interoperability with other protocols. Now that said, that could change very quickly with like an easy integration. When like, let's say for example, our smart contract for language rolls out at the beginning of next year, and you have a project like Chainlink that wants to sort of like act as like an oracle that interoperates with the smart contracts. Yeah, sure, definitely do that. But I'd say all this needs to be considered through the lens of how your project is delivering on their core promise and how they're building a trusted brand. And that's what I believe is actually most exciting about the whole blockchain space, is that we're moving to an age where trusted brands, like people's trust in our major institutions, political, technological, et cetera, and like just big biz or whatever, has been falling over time. And I think what we're actually trending toward now is an era where people will want more and more trust because they haven't been able to trust the old institutions. And I think that's what we're kind of focused on, which is like building, making sure we can deliver on our core promise and that the apps in our ecosystem can. I think interoperability is great for experimentation, but I think it's like orthogonal to our core, to like what we're trying to accomplish at the moment.
Amazing. No, that makes a lot of sense and very well explained. So before we wrap up here, I got a couple more questions. Some of the questions that we like to ask everybody that comes on to Crypto 101. And the first one is just going to be, you know, if this is the first podcast that somebody, you know, who's just now getting into the space has heard, first podcast, you know, what would be one word of advice as they enter into this space that we call crypto?
Don't believe anyone.
I love it. That's good. That's short and sweet. That's just yeah. Fucking do your own research.
Absolutely. And then even then, be careful.
Yep.
Definitely don't use Reddit as a source of wealth or source of material in that case.
Yeah. I mean, this is the crypto ecosystem is, I think for many people, it actually makes them a better person. In terms of like, you know, hot, like learning to save money, because, you know, for example, with Bitcoin, it's kind of like, well, yeah, it's like winning the lottery in slow motion. So you have this very direct incentive to like not let any Bitcoin go. And that's their core promise, sound money, right? And also I think the trusted brand thing, I think people are going to have to be more and more transparent with what's going on under the hood of their protocol. And under their apps and things like that, and so, you know, they're sort of I think bad actors will naturally be rejected from the crypto ecosystem because it's kind of like a completely new thing. You know, you're dealing with bearer instruments, you're dealing with public and private keys. You mess something up, it's kind of like, it's usually kind of permanent or like it damages you in some way that wouldn't normally damage a regular company.
All right, Patrick. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was really interesting to learn about Blockstack And I can't wait to see all the things that are coming in the future. As soon as that big killer app hits, there's a great chance it's going to be from your platform.
Yeah, I'm excited too. Thanks for having me on. This is a blast.
Our pleasure.
All right, take care.
Cheers.
See you.
So as we've traveled around the world, we had this idea that everyone should have a chance to be included in getting the same kind of information and knowledge required to make good investment choices. And with that, we decided to put on our own conference, online and completely free, at crypto2020summit.com.
Yes, Pizza Mind is very correct. We are putting on the Crypto 2020 Summit. This is a free online conference from January 29th to 31st. And we want everybody who's listening to this to go sign up. It's free only for a limited time. This is a conference that you guys can tune into on your computer, at your home. You could be in your PJs. You could be sipping tea. It's going to be awesome. Every day we're adding more speakers to the lineup. You could go check it out at www.crypto2020summit.com. Pause this episode right now. If you haven't signed up yet, you could do it on your mobile. You could do it on your iPad. You could do it on your BlackBerry. You could do it on your MacBook. Do it. Do it. As Shia LaBeouf would say, just do it. And Nike. Okay, bye.